Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all find a common root in one man, and that man is Abraham. Abraham and his story have engaged and fascinated people for a long time. Certainly many writers, philosophers, other kinds of thinkers have been interested in Abraham, among them Kierkegaard and Jean-Paul Sartre and Sigmund Freud, just to name three. And also our guest for this part of Focus 580, his name is David Rosenberg. He's a poet, essayist, and critic. And he encourages us in his new book, which is titled Abraham, the First Historical Biography. He encourages us to think about Abraham not as a mythological or symbolic figure, but as a real person, a real man of flesh and blood. Someone who was important, perhaps not because, as some people would think, that he somehow invented monotheism, but perhaps because he refined it, taking the tradition into which he was born, in which having a relationship with an individual God was actually something that was natural and certainly was common. Taking that and taking it to another level, which perhaps presented yet another relationship between human beings and their God. He writes about this in this book, and again, it's titled Abraham, the First Historical Biography. It is published by Basic Books. It's out now. David Rosenberg is the former editor-in-chief of the Jewish Publication Society. He was Harold Bloom's co-author on The Book of Jay, and he has also written two other books, A Poet's Bible and The Lost Book of Paradise, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome, as always. People can be involved in the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that they just try to be brief so that we can get in as many as possible and keep things moving along. Anybody can join us by calling the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. And that one's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana, or if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Rosenberg, hello.
Hi, it's good to be with you again.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I enjoyed the talk. I don't know how many years ago it's been. We talked about the Poet's Bible. It's been quite a while.
Yes, it has.
Tell us, and I guess as soon as I saw the book, I thought this would be, it would make an interesting conversation. And I was thinking, at least for no other reason than so many different people have been engaged by Abraham and the story of his life. So tell me, what was it about Abraham that wanted to, made you want to spend so much more time with the story? And as I say, I think one of the things that you really encourage us to do is to try to think about Abraham as a real person. What drew you to him?
Well, to begin with, there are plenty of Abrahams walking around in the state of Illinois and Ibrahims walking around in Iraq today. So there's no lack of reason to be thinking about an Abraham. But for myself, it started in this specific way, after the Book of Jay, a book which dealt with the author of Abraham's story, among other portions of what's called the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. And it was looking over the shoulder of the author Jay, at the story of Abraham in particular, that made me realize we didn't quite get to the core of it in the Book of Jay, and I wasn't sure exactly even what that core was until I began looking at it more closely and realizing that it was the history of Abraham that was missing for us but was not missing for the original audience. And what I mean by that is, if you have a real person as opposed to a legend, then every real person has history of the of their own. They have parents, they have ancestors, they have a city and a life that they live and so on, all of which has to be filled in. And you are given the outline of this in Genesis. We are told who Abraham's parents are and his ancestors, and we are told a little about his father, Terah, and what he did before Abraham started to, what we could call, think for himself. By think for himself, I mean think differently than his father. And I realized that what was the most misunderstood part of the Abraham story is that all the focus, even among those you mentioned early, Kierkegaard and so on, all the focus was on his God rather than on the man himself. And the closer you look at the text, you see that it really is not about his God very much at all, but almost all centered on the man and written as a biography, written as, in fact, the first historical biography in our civilization. That's why the subtitle has an ironic side to it. The first historical biography of a man who was an ordinary man, not a king or a famous warrior or anything like that. And as I looked at this sense of history, I began to ask myself, what did the original audience and author know that we have forgotten or lost? And you realize a tremendous amount, because obviously if you were living in 10th century BCE Jerusalem and you were an educated person, a few thousand educated people at that time, and you were reading the first reconstruction of Abraham's life based on earlier Hebraic sources, you would know about the history that Abraham came from. That is, both the classical civilization he studied, Sumer and Sumerian studies, and the actual places like the city of Ur that he came from, because they were part of your life at the time. It's been totally lost for us, so people 100 years ago would have had no idea. For them, Sumer might as well have been Shangri-La. I mean, not a real place they would know how to think about. But in the last 100 years, little more than 100 years, we have dug up clay tablets and many other items in the ground of what was early Mesopotamia and the civilization of Sumer, as well as later civilizations there. And we've begun to translate the language it was originally written in, called cuneiform, and interpret it. And this has all happened just in the actual final interpretation of it just in the last few decades. And so just now are we able, for the first time in maybe 2,000 years, to actually think back about how Abraham had a history, was a man, and therefore represents for us the first man of the civilization we know today, the kind of civilization we live in today, which is common to us both not just in Christianity and in Islam, but in the entire West.
Let's talk a little bit about the culture into which Abraham, or Abram, I guess is what his name was before it was Abraham.
Abram is the Sumerian. That's a Sumerian name. Anyone familiar with those studies understands it right away. And he changed it to Abraham the same way that any immigrant coming to the United States whose name might have been Wilsenkrantz shortened it to Wilson. It was a natural, or changed it. I mean, it was a natural thing to do, and so it was Hebraicized.
Let's talk about the culture into which he was born and which influenced, what you're arguing influenced him a great deal. What are the important things that one should know about Sumerian culture and how that would have left a stamp on Abraham?
Yes, and also on us, because in many serious ways we are Latter-day Sumerians, and we don't know it, and it's really part of the problem that, or shall I say, part of the confusion today about what's going on in the Middle East. What I mean by Latter-day Sumerians is this: Sumer was the first great civilization. There were some antecedents, but Sumer was the first one that, because it invented writing. And this, we're talking about more than 5,000 years ago. Because it invented writing and loved writing and wrote so much and wrote incredible texts, wrote down all its own historical, mythological legends, as well as wrote on everything. They wrote on buildings. They wrote on statues. They were in love with writing, and that's the reason that we know how much they represented the first great civilization and what they did with it. And what they did, besides the writing, we find that they invented so many things that our 20th century almost looks like a kindergarten in comparison. I mean, sure, we invented flight and rockets and computers and several other things. But if you think about the range of things that the Sumerians invented in their time, everything from wheels to sails to canals to beer to almost anything, you realize what a creative, inventive time this was. And of course, and as well as domesticating animals, or certain animals were domesticated before, but the donkey was the most important domesticated animal at that time because it made it possible for the trade that went down from Iraq through what was called Canaan and is now Israel today to Egypt. And all this trade and interconnectedness happened almost exclusively because of a certain breed of donkeys that the Sumerians bred and that could make this trek. And but that's not the biggest thing. I'm just giving you one small example. Now, the way that they are like us today is that their idea of civilization was about boundaries. And the most crucial boundary for them was the one between religion and secular life. And it's the one we're still struggling for today. People are crossing it all the time, and they're saying, hey, you crossed that boundary, or vice versa, from the other side. The whole sense of where that boundary is, we're not talking about a simple, superficial idea of separation of church and state now, because we're talking about something much deeper. The area of religion goes far deeper into every individual than simply the institution of the church, and the same for individual consciousness when it relates to the state. So that sense of boundary was something the Sumerians focused upon in their religion and in the relationship to their secular culture. This was ingrained in Abraham because he studied it. He had to in the schools he went to. Ur, the city he came from, was full of schools. And he took this with him and transformed it, in a sense, to the boundary that became called in the Bible the covenant, and what Abraham called the covenant. The covenant was just a word for contract. Contracts were very important in Sumer because civilization is based on the notion of a contract and or a constitution. And that contract, or that covenant that Abraham hammered out with his God, was something that was done both in terms of how it had been done before in Sumerian culture and how it could be now done by an individual person, an individual man, with his own sense of a personal God, or let's just say a representative of the unknowable. You don't have to think about God in any more specific way than merely to understand that in this time and in all civilizations, he represents the unknowable. What, in other words, could never be known by a limited human being, and what we sense we could never know.
Well, the thing that I think is interesting, again, you make this argument that these people, the people of Sumer, would have had two sort of religious spheres, a public one and a private one. And in the public one, it was crowded with gods. There were gods in temples and there were priests everywhere. And that people might have visited temples and they might have taken part in various rituals. But that, in fact, that everyone would have had a god that they would have felt that perhaps they had some sort of personal relationship with. So it wasn't, and that that was an idea that Abraham would have taken with him, so that it perhaps the what was revolutionary was not so much the idea of monotheism, but what was revolutionary was the and perhaps not even the idea that one would could have a relationship, personal relationship with a God. Maybe it was the nature of the relationship itself that was the thing that was perhaps revolutionary.
Well, of course, and that is true, and that is what we want to understand from the point of view of the man, of Abraham, rather than from the point of view of God, which is covered very well in our theological departments. So that is, we do want to understand how the what I call the cosmic theater of Sumer became the theater, the cosmic theater of Abraham's God. That's basically covering the question that you're asking. And you were, in a sense, just the way you introduced this question, you were describing a kind of theater. You described how the Sumerians were familiar with lots of gods, and but in addition, they had their own personal god, which was called, it was not supposed, it was real, it was the household god. Every family, in other words, had a god, and this god just represented the family wisdom. It was not a you know, a belief in some sort of figure. It was basically a character, a representative of a god who embodied the wisdom of your family that went back many generations. And this is a wisdom you needed in a time like this, when governments and regimes of all kinds would change so rapidly. What you really needed was the wisdom of your family, which went back many generations. And especially when it came to making big decisions like, should I just get up and leave this whole place? I mean, that's a pretty big decision after my family's been living here for, like, at least 10 generations. That kind of question, you would refer to your household god, which really means just consult the family wisdom. What happened? Have others in the family tried this before? Well, in fact, the Bible tells you right there in Genesis that Terah, who was Abraham's father, had tried it. He had left Ur, but and he was going to Canaan, that is, further. These were not the first Semites in Mesopotamia to emigrate, that is. But the point is that the Bible then tells you that Terah stopped. He just couldn't go any further. He stopped in Haran, and that city is still in the same Mesopotamian culture that Ur was. And so it was there in Haran, where Abraham was already a mature man, that he went further on this journey. He, in a sense, heard again or asked his God, his personal God, that advice. And this is just a theatrical representation. And what did the answer come? The answer came, it may be time to, that's understood, it may be time to get up and leave your homeland, leave your family, leave your past. And that is how we hear God first enter the story in Abraham's life.
One of the things that you see in the story of his life, and perhaps, since I don't mean to be too flippant, in a lot of these stories, is that people are always moving. They don't stay still. There's a lot of stories that have to do with journeys and people going, particularly people going from places that they knew to places that they didn't. And as you say in the story that the Terah took his sons out of Ur, where this family had been for a long time, settled in Haran, and then he stayed there. That was as far as he could go. But Abram, he left from there, and then he left. He settled again, and then he moved again. So one of the questions I guess you'd have to ask is, what is driving him now? You could say on the one level it was his God that was saying go. I'm not sure that's a completely
right.
Satisfying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The That's exactly why I had to write this book. the answer to your question, and we should say for your listeners that the reasons behind everything that I'm asserting here are in the book. I obviously can't go into them in a short talk like this,
sure.
But all the reasons are in the book. The reason historically, as opposed to mythologically, it's very important. Let me just back up one second. It's so important today. It's almost comes up every day in conversations that I have anywhere I go, even Starbucks with the barista. And that is, what do we possibly have in common with these people in the Middle East, in Iraq, who are Islamic? What do we have in common when our religions are so apparently diverged in terms of how they face issues of civilization? And the answer usually comes is a political one. Well, we have to make some kind of political accommodation, and I always wonder and ask myself. Certainly, we're no different than the people at the time of the Bible and the people much earlier than the Bible. Abraham, of course, lived 8-9 generations before the Bible even began to be written. We all have the same genes. We all have exactly the same DNA. We are no different in terms of our intellectual, mental capabilities or our language capabilities. So the question is, what did these people deal with when it came to differences between each other? And, of course, the best way to represent difference is with a journey, because that's going to take you to a different place where you have to compare what you know with other people. Now, you can say in a sense, I'm not trying to be too mordant here, you can say in a sense that today we have journeyed to Iraq, we, the American people, have our civilization has journeyed to Iraq and are being confronted with a different civilization. And what I am conscious of throughout the Book of Abraham that I worked on, the first historical biography, what I'm conscious of is not so much the differences, but the immense similarities. And the primary similarity is not about religion, it's about civilization. Ultimately, our notion of civilization and the Sumerian notion of civilization are very similar, and the Sumerians are as integral to the history of Iraqis as certainly as much as it is for us, but it's unknown to them. Just as Christianity pretty much covered up the history of Sumer and later Mesopotamian civilizations, so did Islam. And people know very little about not just what the art and statues looked like, but about how people lived and thought, and more important, negotiated their first civilization that was in relationship to other civilizations. It wasn't simply an empire. It was one which acknowledged and understood and dealt with every day how to deal with other cultures. And that's the issue that's driving Abraham. What's driving him, of course, historically, to answer your question, what's driving him is that his civilization in Ur that he grew up and studied in, and as well as in Haran, is falling apart. At his time, historically, we have all kinds of evidence now that pretty much the ascent of Babylon, which happened in his time, and a king we remember well today called Hammurabi, this was pretty much at the time of Abraham, and the rise of Babylon and the creation of the Babylonian Empire pretty much put an end to all the classical civilization, especially the civilization of Sumer, that went before. And in doing so, it pretty much smashed all the, what should we call them, nuances, pretty much smashed all the really fine detail, all the great, what I would call the great theater of Sumer, and reduced it all to what I would call monumentalism. Instead of one gorgeous, beautiful Mona Lisa painting, for example, they said, hey, we can do better than that. Let's make one 10 feet tall. Somehow you're going to lose the Mona Lisa if you try to copy it and make it 10 feet tall. And that's pretty much what happened in the monumentalizing empire of Babylon. What was lost was not the Mona Lisa, but the great theater, cosmic theater of Sumer. And I keep calling it that for one reason. Let me just go back to it. We all know when you go to a theater of any kind, including a movie, the most crucial thing you have to do is suspend your disbelief. You have got to, for the hour or 2 hours or whatever it is, enter into the drama that's being presented to you. If you don't, you're going to have a lousy time. You might as well not be there. Now, the same is true in church. I mean, you wouldn't want to go to church without, in some sense, suspending your disbelief. If you have disbelief, of course, if you have belief, you don't have a problem. But if you don't, or if it's even in the slightest doubt, we're going to suspend that doubt while we're in church and participate in the great drama of the church service. And then when we go out of the church, we may still have a little doubt that comes back. So the suspended disbelief comes back. Now, in the Sumerian temple, this was not only the case, but it was conscious. People understood when they went to the temple that they were going to see a great drama, and that when they left the temple, that was over. They had gone to the theater, the drama was over, and they now got back to their extremely creative, secular lives. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been that creative. And so I'm saying the connection between understanding that and seeing how it works today for us makes it possible for us to see how Abraham himself had to work this all out, how he could take this culture that was dying at the time with him, make it a portable culture, take it with him to Canaan, and in a sense reinvent it. It was very hard. He had to make very difficult choices. He had to decide that he was not going to educate his children in the local school system. Obviously, he educated them himself, and they did not go to Canaanite schools. Isaac would have had to have been educated enough to record his father's journey, and that's how we still have it today. So I'm just beginning to answer your question. The details, of course, is what I went into during many years, and they're in the book. Mm-hmm.
And that, again, for people who would like to read the book, it's Abraham, the First Historical Biography, and it's published by Basic Books by our guest, David Rosenberg. He's poet, essayist, and critic. Former editor-in-chief of the Jewish Publication Society, was Harold Bloom's co-author on The Book of Jay, and also himself wrote The Poet's Bible and The Lost Book of Paradise, and he's joining us by phone. We have some other, callers here, so we want to bring some people into the conversation, and we will do that starting with someone over in Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. There's some pretty strong archaeological evidence that Abraham was a real person, that he really lived. Specifically, there's a carving, a wall carving in the Karnak Temple in Egypt. This carving depicts an Egyptian military campaign, which actually occurred 950 years after Abraham. But it mentions Abraham. It mentions a field that is called the Field of Abraham. In other words, 950 years after Abraham, this field was still called the Field of Abraham. And the story is in the Bible that Abraham bought a field to bury his wife after his wife died. And the Bible record of Abraham buying that field is in Genesis 23. Anybody can read it. In that story, Abraham pays 400 shekels of silver for the field. And 950 years later, when the Egyptians were writing a story of their military exploits, they mention that field, and it's still called the Field of Abraham. But by the way, the record of that Egyptian military campaign is also in the Bible. It's recorded in the Bible in two places. So there's some pretty good, pretty strong archaeological evidence that the Bible is true. You know that we have a very distinguished Christian archaeologist, William Foxwell Albright. He's called the dean. Well, he's deceased now, but he's called the dean of archaeologists. And Dr. Albright said there can be no doubt that archaeology has confirmed the substantial historicity of the Old Testament tradition. That's what he says. So there's some pretty.
I'm very glad to hear you say that. Of course, I had to read Albright's works long ago, and but I'm afraid, and I'm sure you know this too, there's plenty of doubt. It doesn't matter that you you have historical evidence that you interpret as evidence. There are still plenty of people who can interpret it as non-evidence in a different context. So we still have the problem of proving the historicity. We can't just, I'm sure you understand, 9 out of 10 people who ask me questions about this book are coming from the feeling that Abraham was not a real person, but was a legend or a myth, because after all, most of the legends deal with supernatural material. And we know the historical Abraham you are describing, of course, is not a supernatural man, and the history you're describing is very natural. Of course, an Egyptian campaign, archaeological evidence, all this is historical. The problem always begins when people begin to confuse the supernatural with the natural, and that's why it's so important for us, people like you and me, to clarify where the boundaries are between the natural and the supernatural. This is something that consumed Abraham in the story of his life. And the part that you mentioned, which is actually the one of the last chapters in his life when he has to find a plot to bury his wife Sarah, and of course for himself later, that field that you're talking about, that chapter is not really about names. It's not about the name of Abraham, the field of Abraham, or anything like that. It's really about, it's called Death and Burial in my book, but it's really about extinction and the problem we have with extinction. We want there to be a supernatural continuation of our life in the sense of an afterlife. This is something that Abraham, in his Sumerian classical education, understood was not something that could be credible. And so, therefore, his concern with extinction was that he passed down through education and through contractual nature, like by establishing a covenant with his children, that the question of inheritance, what had to be done to avoid the extinction of his culture, because he had just seen the Sumerian culture, which had lasted over 2,000 years, become pretty much extinct. So I hope I'm engaging your question. It's not your question was not just a question. It was a whole statement that I'm trying to engage.
And I get just, again, I hope the caller forgive me for wanting to go on, but there might be things that you might want to discuss or disagree with the caller, but I don't think that between you and him that there's any dispute on the point of whether Abraham actually was a real person. You're in fact arguing, yes, Abraham was a real person.
But we need to establish it because people don't believe it. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to believe that a real person went around as if he were a puppet of a supernatural god. And that is unfortunately the way that most legends represent him, and many sermons misrepresent him, as if he were a puppet, as if his whole significance was that he was obedient to God. He did what God said. God told him to go. He did that. God told him to take his son and bind him on a mountain. He did that. I mean, all of that is a tremendous misrepresentation of the actual historicity, and that's why we continue to have to fight for it today.
Well, that's an interesting point, and one I wanted to get to, because I think that probably for a lot of people who know the story, no matter what faith tradition you come out of, they would say that that is the point that you're supposed to take away from the story. That is that faithfulness to God will be rewarded. If God says do something, do it, even if he says take your son out and sacrifice him. The point of all of that, at least as we all were taught in Sunday school, was that it's going to be okay. And it seems like your argument that, in fact, that's really not the important thing to be drawn from the life of Abraham.
David, let me just say that not only is it not the important lesson, it's just not there. And it's not really what we were taught, but you know, when we were children, everything was about it's going to be okay. It wasn't just Sunday school. You know, if you have children of your own, you know that you have to do a lot of reassuring, and you have to tell them that whatever event that they run into that is problematic, it's going to be okay. And so that interpretation would be a natural one to tell children, but it's not the story. It's not the real story. It's certainly not the adult story, which is the Bible that we have, a very adult book. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to grapple with.
Well, let's talk with someone else. In Champaign County, on line one. Hello?
Oh, I have something else, but what did you mean by it's not there? You mean, quoting the bard from Hibbing, God said, Abraham, kill me a son? What are you saying? That's not in the story?
Thank you so much for bringing up Bobby Zimmerman.
Yeah?
Because the fact is that if you listen to that song, and I was a teenager when I first heard, in fact, I was pre-teenager when I first heard that song, and I knew from the way that he sang it that it was ironic. I mean, if you don't know that just the accent that Bob Dylan uses is ironic, then you are not with him, shall we say. And the point is that God said, Abraham, take me your son, and all that.
Kill me a son.
Pardon me?
Kill me a son.
Yeah. All that is a kind of, what should we say, hyperbolizing, that understands that the actual story is not literal. In other words, if you want to make fun of someone, you literalize what they say. You take what they say literally, and in a way that makes fun of them. The fact is that the story in the Bible of what's called the binding of Isaac, because he is, of course, not sacrificed, but that story is not a literal story. It's not a story in which God said this, and he said that, and he did that. That is not the story at all, and I explain that in the book. What you are given in the book, what you are given is a dream. You are given a dream in which, just imagine a dream for a second, because what I'm telling you is that the biblical writers, who were great writers, did not need to tell you you're about to enter a dream, just as if you're watching a movie, you don't have a big sign telling you this is about to be a dream. Instead, things change, and things change totally in that story. Just think back to the stories before about Abraham, in which he's a great questioner, a great arguer with God. Here, everything has changed. He doesn't say a word. He just does what he's told. He's sleepwalking. You know, he walks through that entire scene as if he's a somnambulist. And he is in a dream, but it becomes very quickly a nightmare. And we all have nightmares, and in nightmares we work out some of our deepest problems. We don't need Freud to tell us this. We work out some of our deepest problems, including our deepest desires we can't even admit to ourselves, that we might want to kill somebody, that we might want to kill anybody, even our own parents, and vice versa, our own children. This is not something we would ever admit to consciousness. But sometimes it's worked out in dreams, and here you have a perfect example, and I go through it very carefully, how the original author, in this case, his name was E., I designated that by biblical scholarship, described this as a nightmare in which, what's the most crucial thing about a nightmare? It's that you have to wake up from it. If Abraham did not wake up from his nightmare, then Bob Dylan's irony about it would have been correct. In other words, it would have been a tragic scene of killing a son, or of a God telling a man to kill a son. But know that what happens is that Abraham wakes up from this nightmare, and he doesn't need God to wake him up. What wakes him up? The most natural thing in the world, the sound of a ram, which, of course, in those days, and if you're out there in the country, a ram getting caught in a thicket is a very natural thing to happen. They have very big horns, and then he'd be making quite a racket trying to get his horns disentangled, and that would definitely wake you up if you were sleeping. But this is not sleeping. This is a representation of a dream, a
I'm not saying it's a real dream. It's a representation of a nightmare. It requires some intelligence on your part, some ability to enter the drama the way you would in a theater. And that is why the sense of relief in from this nightmare, the sense that Isaac is not sacrificed, is so deep. It's because it's not up to God. It's just a natural occurrence. It's just something that happens because we're alive in a natural world, and that's what the ram signifies. And then, of course, later rams are used quite normally in temple sacrifice. I hope I addressed your question.
Yeah, it's a lot to chew on, but
sure it is.
It wasn't what I was actually thinking of calling on, but it sort of does highlight the idea of you're pushing everything to be historically possible in some way, and not being a myth. My understanding is that, I mean, I don't even particularly think that there was a historical Jesus in the sense that all of the stories that are attached to him are necessarily about one and the same person, because obviously the Zoroastrian stories that underlie some of these parables are an argument that this was going from an oral tradition to a literal tradition. But I'm wanting to you to comment on Baruch Halperin. He studies at Pennsylvania, and his book
Penn
is
State.
Penn State, yeah. The idea that he went through and did a historical analysis and said this, you know, Solomon was aggrandizing King David for his own reasons, I think one of his chapters is called David Serial Killer or something like that. But I don't know the book, but it informs a long time ago I read a book by Isaac Asimov called The Guide to the Bible, and he goes through what was known then about the history and shows that stories in the Bible are transposed centuries at a time, and stories told about one person were actually transposed into another situation, something that, you know, people who are telling stories naturally do.
Listen, I think I know what you're getting at, and tell me if I'm wrong. There's a huge difference between Isaac Asimov or Baruch Halperin or anybody else claiming in any way to interpret the Bible as history or to tell you that it's history, and you're absolutely right, of course, that is what they're doing. There's a difference between that and telling you that the Bible is written as history. That is, not only are we as modern people interpreting it as history, but it was written to be a history. And it was written to be a history in a way that we don't understand because we don't have the cultural context that it was written in. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, why call it a history if we're using an idea that it's a, you know, semi-science of history and imposing it on a cultural culture that told stories for different reasons? So I just don't. Why does one want to hang on to it being history, even
exactly,
in your sense, or even the fundamentalist sense?
That is the core question. Really, I'm glad we come back to it. First of all, you refer to them as stories. And, you know, stories is an abbreviated term for history, as you just take off the HIS, or the HI. Now, I'm saying there's a, I don't call them stories, I'm calling them history, but you see, history has to be written with something called the art of narrative, or the art of history. And so we have to separate the art of the telling from the sources. And that's what I'm trying to do in the book. Of course, obviously we can't do that right here. But the fact is that if it was written to be history at the time, and if we can understand this, then what we will be understanding is not simply that Abraham did this, Abraham did that. I'm not concerned with establishing the historicity. I do assume that it has begun to be established in a modern sense. I'm concerned with what we can learn from it, what we need to learn from it if we're ever going to get past the confusion of mixing up the natural with the supernatural. Because the Bible was completely concerned with clarifying that confusion, with unmixing the natural from the supernatural, with showing you that when they interact, it is in a special way. It's in a way that was historical.
historically defined, and that's what I'm getting at in the book. What we really need to know about Abraham is where the whole idea of the soul came from and why there is such an idea. And, I mean, you know, Aristotle and every other philosopher worth his salt also discussed the nature of the soul. The question is, how do we look at it as a natural phenomenon, not just a supernatural one? How do we look at it as the inner life, the inner consciousness, or what Freud called the subconscious, and actually compare it with what our experience of the natural world is? That is what's going on in Abraham. He's negotiating. In every recording of his history, the crucial thing is not he went there, he did that, or God said that. The crucial thing is how he negotiates his understanding of what is happening to him. What is happening in Sodom and Gomorrah? What is happening when God talks to him along the way? It's his inner consciousness that we're being given. Now, you might ask me, well, how can you write history about inner consciousness? Well, it isn't obviously explicit, it's implicit. If I write a biography of Abraham Lincoln, I can give you a sense of his inner life. I don't have to tell you that I had a tape recorder going in his insides, because of course there's no such thing. I have to interpret it for you. And so what this history of Abraham is interpreting for you is how man reconciles his inner life with his outer life experience.
But you're not, it sounds, I'm thinking people might say that you're making some kind of argument that in fact when Abraham is talking to God that he's somehow talking to himself.
It's interesting, you know, when you're a writer you listen to words very carefully. And let me just quote you back to yourself.
Yes.
Somehow talking to himself. It's a very interesting phrase. Somehow, I would focus on the word somehow and say, I'm afraid you're right. He is somehow talking to himself. The question is, how do we get at that somehow? Mm-hmm. Or rather, how? Mm-hmm. How? What does it mean to talk to yourself? Because I'm not being facetious here. I'm saying talking to yourself is also listening to yourself. Listening to yourself is listening to the nature of what it is to be a human being, what it is to be a Homo sapiens, and to listen to that and to try to get outside of yourself is the whole religious quest, of course. To see ourselves from the point of view of God is to see ourselves from outside of ourselves as this limited Homo sapiens creature. And of course, you have to listen to yourself in many ways, not just to what you're saying, but to what your feelings are and how they contradict and are in contradiction sometimes with your impulses and with your desires. And all of these things are worked out in Abraham's discussions with his God. Now, you know that when you read the Iliad or the Odyssey, you assume that Homer does not really believe that the gods he is constantly invoking, that he really believes them. Because you know that if he really did believe those gods, he couldn't have written these tremendously ironic stories about all his heroes who are actually fallible human beings, like Odysseus. And so no one, when we teach or read the Odyssey in university, no one is saying you have to understand and believe the whole Greek God belief system in order to understand the Odyssey. And we're saying the same thing about Abraham's God. Obviously, we never can really know what Abraham's God was for him, Abraham in his time. We are doing our best to interpret it. But the writer who was representing Abraham and his God many centuries later in Jerusalem, that writer, and for the most part J and sometimes E and a little bit P, that writer J, let's say, is very much representing God as if he were, is it when Shakespeare represents the muse. When a writer invokes the muse, he's invoking a convention. He's saying, okay, I understand that inspiration is not a limited human thing. It comes from outside. And this is the same situation in which you do want to understand, and it doesn't matter whether you're religious or not, you do want to understand that the inspiration behind Abraham's history comes from outside of himself, not just from inside of himself. And it has to be represented. And it can be represented badly in all kinds of ridiculous legends, supernatural legends we have about Abraham. And it can represent it by great writers, and that's what we have in the Bible.
I wish we could continue, but I'm sorry we've used our time, and we'll have to stop. People can pursue this further by looking at the book, Abraham, the First Historical Biography, by our guest David Rosenberg. It's published by Basic Books. David Rosenberg is poet, essayist, and critic. His other books include A Poet's Bible and The Lost Book of Paradise, and also his the book he co-authored with Harold Bloom, The Book of Jay. And Mr. Rosenberg, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.